Welcome to my Bob Thurman podcast. I'm so grateful some good friends enabled me to present them to you. If you enjoy them and find them useful, please think of becoming a member of Tibet House US to help preserve Tibetan culture. Tibet House is the Dalai Lama's cultural center in America. All best wishes. Have a great day.
This is episode 156, Compassion and the Intrinsic Reality of Miss Piggy.
Phew. Okay, so we're preparing for His Holiness, who's going to teach the essence of the essence of true eloquence in 2 days in November, and his favorite work of Indo-Tibetan philosophy. It draws on draws on his understanding of the tradition coming from Nagarjuna, of course from Shakyamuni Buddha, Prajnaparamita Sutras, and then Nagarjuna, and then all the way down in India until Tibet, and then through the various teachers in Tibet. There's a tradition in Tibet that they're called the three Manjushris. And of course, Manjushri is, as I think I mentioned to people last time, is the Buddha who made a vow that when he was, after being a Buddha, he would be a bodhisattva in all worlds where Buddhas were teaching transcendent wisdom, prajnaparamita, and which people call perfection of wisdom, which is another possible translation. And it's the wisdom that transcends ordinary dualistic knowledge, the wisdom that understands everything by becoming everything, something like that. So in a way, it's not transcendent in the sense of leaving the universe, but it's transcendence in terms of merging with the universe, transcending the isolated subjectivity that perceives other things as alien objects. And then whenever Buddha's teaching that subject, then Manjushri incarnates there, supposedly, and he asks the question, that's the tough question of the Buddha, like, what are you talking about? Okay, so then there are, you know, for thousands of years, there are different interpretations of this, because one thing, and the highest interpretation of it is that there's no dogmatic or formulaic description of what reality is. In other words, no theory, it's only mind, or it's this or that, captures reality. Reality eludes the dualistic concepts, okay? But in a way that describes reality, that negation. In other words, the negation that all concepts, that any concept can encapsulate reality, that is reality, that negation. It opens the mind to that reality. And the mind understands that reality as you understand a negation. For example, which is not that mysterious, don't look worried. if someone says there's no elephant in this room, or say no live elephant in this room, somebody may have an elephant charm bracelet or something, there's no live elephant in this room, then you look around the room, if it's a really big room or something, and you look under things or wherever there could be an elephant according to what you think an elephant might be. And at some point you decide it's not necessary to keep looking. It isn't like you come to closure over a certain thing, like you do in a dualistic piece of knowledge. You say, that's a pillar. And it seems to correspond to your concept of a pillar. So So it's like bang, you know, it's like you close, your concept closes on the pillar. And that's one kind of cognition. But reality cannot be closed on like that. However, there's no elephant in the room. Living elephant in the room. You never close on anything. It's just you don't find the elephant you try to find. Do you follow me? So similarly, emptiness means that things are empty of some sort of intrinsic essence, some sort of non-relational thing, in other words, that resists analysis and that is the composer, that is the constituent, the sort of ultimate irreducible constituent of reality. And when you don't find any such thing, when everything dissolves under analysis, and experiential analysis as well as analytic or verbal analysis, in other words, you sort of develop because you develop a higher power of concentration. If anybody needs a text, Tajila is coming around with text, then things will actually disappear in front of you. For example, the Buddha on the morning of his enlightenment, highest enlightenment, everything disappeared. And many people would then think that, oh, enlightenment is some sort of thing where the world disappears, so there's no more problem of the world, right? But the problem is that the disappearance also disappeared. And when the disappearance disappears, then what's there? Everything is back in a different way, if you follow me. In other words, emptiness itself is empty, meaning even the concept of sort of negation, of being empty of something and you don't find anything, and the experience of not finding anything is in a way like a finding of disappearance. It's like the finder disappears, the findable disappears. But then that state of disappearing also disappears. So then you're back, in a way. And everything else is back. But you're back, perhaps you're back in a different way. For example, I think we will reach today in talking about the second wheel of Dharma, which we will come to, and that is the idea of the unborn nature of reality, the unproduced nature of the universe, the uncreated nature. What is the solution? You know, people in the West or in a theistic culture, which are most cultures, and also people by their common sense experience who see things having beginnings and endings, people then think, well, everything is here, like how did it all begin? And then the pretension of the high priest in a religious or theistic culture, and nowadays the pretension of the high priests of secular materialism, which are MIT scientists and Columbia scientists and NYU scientists and Harvard scientists, etc., their pretension is, oh yeah, they got it, the Big Bang. It was the first milliseconds of the Big Bang. There was cosmic inflation. And sometimes they get a little embarrassed by that kind of a claim, like, oh, there was a Big Bang out of where? Out of nothing. You know, and then the creatio ex nihilo, you know, ancient theological, you know, creation out of nothingness. But then they feel a little uncomfortable having their theory replace God. So they then say, well, maybe it's a black hole in another universe. And it just looks like nothing, but the whole energy of the other universe was compressed into this infinite black hole. There's a seat over here, my dear. Hello. There's a seat right here, but, you know, you're a little bit near the wind here, so maybe you prefer to be more peaceful in the back. So then they come up with all these kind of things, like it was that there's, you know, another one before that, because actually, commonsensically, you never find a beginning of anything out of nothing. In fact, it's completely incoherent to talk about anything out of nothing. And even the theological thing of God created everything out of nothing, God wasn't nothing, and he was hanging around. So it all came out of him, that means. That just means there's nothing other than him, actually, is what it really means, that theological thing. Because nobody's ever had seen anything come out of nothing. And nobody's ever seen nothing, actually. Actually, there is a meditative realm called the realm of absolute nothingness that the Buddha described as an experience, that you could be confused and think it was nothing. But actually, it's a realm, a meditative realm, where you sort of get stuck in a state of things having disappeared and you having disappeared. And it's a trap, actually, because your subliminal consciousness has constructed the idea of nothing, and then you're sort of in this black space, and then you become this black, dark space, and then you disappear. And you think, geez, wait, that's really what was really there. And so it's your experience of a kind of a medium or a space. But it's obviously not nothing, because you experienced it, and then you come back from that experience. Although they say if someone has that experience as a high yogi meditator, yogini or yogi meditator, and they misinterpret it, they become nihilistic. And they say a theoretical nihilist, like a secular materialist, is someone you can still talk to. But an experiential nihilist is hopeless. You cannot talk to them. Because they have a reference in their mind of that time when I was nothing. And so they're holding onto that like a real solid something, that experience. But of course, it's a something for them. It's not nothing. Because nothing is nothing. That's a big eureka. Nothing is nothing. It's the beginning to wake up from our psychosis that we live in, the psychosis of thinking that our language means things in some realistic way, to realize that nothing is nothing. There's no referent for nothing. It's a designation that has no referent. Okay? Okay, so I'm not going to go back over the opening verses for those of you who were not here. But just let it be said that Tsongkhapa, well, just quickly to bring you up to speed a little bit of where we're going to go, we're going to start on the second page. This Lama Tsongkhapa, who lived 1357, passed away in 1419. Although he passed away in a rather extraordinary manner, they say, his disciples were present, and his body turned into a 16-year-old youth. And then he met with a female angel, and the two of them went off in one of those yabyums, what they call father-mother union images, and disappeared in a burst of light. And people were pretty, like, flipped out by that, you know. And his disciples. But, you know, maybe they all made it up. Modern scholars would say, well, they mythicalized it, they made it up. We all know that sort of thing can't happen because reality is made out of pre-Einsteinian, pre-quantum atoms. And that couldn't happen to Adams. So never mind. So, but anyway, he had an experience in 1398, 21 years before he died, where he felt he understood everything. And he says so. I have seen it quite precisely by the grace of my guru, the savior Manjugosha, I should say. I don't know how that got to be Gosha. I have to correct that. And that's Manjushri. And I'm going to explain it from great love. Listen, with reverence, you aspire to peerlessness in philosophy, with the critical discrimination that realizes the thatness, the appropriateness, the correctness, the just preciseness of the teaching. And he wrote a poem that morning of that highest awareness that he had, which he maintained then through the next 21 years, and after death even. And he, according to them, and that was called the lesser essence of true eloquence. And then 9 years later, he wrote this book that we're reading, and His Holiness will teach the essence of that essence, which is called the greater essence of true eloquence. Okay, so that is it. So he just salutes to those who he considers his ancestors, spiritual ancestors, because in a way, when you realize that you are spirit, then you more look to your spiritual ancestors than your blood ancestors, actually. Which, of course, is one of the great things about the biological theory of karma, that, you know, karma was a wonderful biological theory, is a wonderful biological theory, and had a big impact in Asia, just in history, whether or not we won't get into whether it's correct or not. We won't get into that now, although there are many arguments that it is. And reincarnation, metempsychosis was just common sense in the Mediterranean 2,000 years ago. So it's widespread world, mundane idea. But the great thing about the biology of karma is that it lessens sexism, nationalism, racism, religious fanaticism. Because, you know, the powers that be, when they try to use, we all hate all the Russians, or we hate all the Muslims, or we hate all the non-Muslims, or we hate the whites, or the blacks, or the yellows, or the purples, or whatever, you know, or we like those who have a different religion, who think God has a different name, or who don't think there is a God, we hate them. These things are all lessened by the fact that maybe in your previous life you were one of them. And maybe next life you'll be one of them again. Like there's a wonderful documented story in the Stevenson literature about this young Burmese woman who, as a small child, kept trying to like roll cigarettes and cigars out of anything she could find, you know, and liked to eat fish raw. She didn't like to cook it, which the Burmese didn't do. And she was trying to make sushi and everything. She had a birthmark in her neck and then this side and this side. And finally, when she got a little older, when she could talk, they realized that she said she was a Japanese soldier who had been killed in the war and with a bullet through his head like that. And they later found the body and everything with the bullet hole in the skull and everything. And she was like trying to like smoke whatever she could find and eat sushi, which they didn't do in that climate, you know, because it was like it's not healthy. Those fish come out of the Mekong. She was like carving them up, you know, or the Irrawaddy, or whatever they call it. And so I shouldn't get distracted. Okay, so the karma theory erodes all of these things. Like the male who thinks they're so great and females are something lesser was a female in the previous life. The female who rightfully thinks males are a pain, she was a male in the previous life, etc. You know, so everybody, it sort of mingles people up, and therefore the Asian people were conquered by the more uptight Western people, which is to their credit. You know, the people who beat the other people up are the lesser people, actually. And the people who are more gentle are the greater people, which someday the history will perhaps tell that story. Nowadays, it's still like onward Christian soldiers, you know, still sung here and there. And we have people at Harvard writing about how the greatness of empire. You know. So we're not quite there yet to recognize that. But we do on our block, if some protection racket starts on our block and somebody comes up and demands protection payment or they'll beat us up, we don't think that's a higher person. We may be scared by them and may be coerced by them, but we don't think they're superior. We don't. We think they're a bunch of bullies and pains, you know. Right? Okay, so that's just a side thing about karma. Okay, now, on page 2, we said the Lord said, the Lord is where we translate Bhagavan, and Bhagavan is one of the names of Buddha. Bhagavan, one who has good luck, actually it means, the lucky one, Bhagavan. Van is a possessive particle, meaning possessing, and Bhaga has a lot of meanings, actually, but it basically means good fortune, it means a share, a Bhaga. It means some other things too, which maybe later I'll tell you, but not now. Anyway, so this is a famous Mahayana sutra, and it's a Dongwa Shiwa Kewa Mepitsul. I've been thinking about this verse all week in Tibetan. Dongwa Shiwa Kewa Mepitsul Misheba Nitola Chamjurwa. I don't know why the Tibetan comes. I don't remember Tibetan verses usually, but this one I kept remembering. So in the translation it says, the way is empty, peaceful, and uncreated. Not knowing that, the living beings wander. Moved by compassion, he introduces them with hundreds of reasons and technical procedures. So, and then in commentary, we have to add a few things, you know. Wander means they wander in the cyclic life. You know, in the six ways of, you know, we are now so fortunate in the Buddhist view. We are human beings. We're human beings born with leisure and intelligence and with our full faculties. And therefore, we have a chance of coming to understand our evolutionary destiny and history and slowly and gradually coming to gain control of what our subliminal subconscious drives are and thereby begin to take control of our evolutionary future and no longer be dragged by lust or hate or greed or confusion or envy or pride into any negative life forms, which of course materialist doesn't worry about because they have the automatic thing that just dying there out of there or the problem is over, right? Materialist. How many of you think, by the way, when you die you're going to be nothing? Don't be embarrassed. How many of you think that? You do? You think so? So you're going to be nothing. Well, I won't go after you. Oh, never mind. It's okay. You're going to be that nothing that doesn't exist. Okay. So, But you can't, but I won't get the argument. Only one person, but probably others do, but the one person brave enough to say. Yeah. And actually, those of us who think, well, I might have a future life, we might be thinking naively that next life I'd rather live in Brooklyn or something. You know, or next life I'd be more whatever, or I'll be, you know, some other thing, or California, you know. And so we're thinking naively that it would sort of just be the same automatically. And then deeper down underneath, we kind of have this feeling that, you know, the materialist doctors and scientists, and they might have found something out, and maybe it is just an old-fashioned superstitious idea. So in a way, we don't viscerally necessarily believe that, because when you viscerally feel that at death you go into like a dream state, like when you fall deep asleep, after some period of being just unconscious, you go into a dream-type state, and then the way you experience that dream-type state and what you see as something, this is a dream-type state where you don't just wake up back in your regular previous body. The kind of early part of the dream, you sort of actually see your body, and at first you don't realize it's you, and then people are making a fuss, and you go up and try to shake their shoulders. You remember the movie Ghost? You know, he was trying to say to his wife, come on, it's me, you know, and that she didn't, you know, only Whoopi could find him, you know, knew he was there, psychic, you know. And so that happens to you after you die, they say, in the early part of the dream. And then you sort of float away from your body, and you can be in another universe, you could be on a different planet, you could be sort of in other sort of planes where you adopt sort of animal forms, depending on your unconscious. And then whatever you gravitate toward, then you're reborn in that form. And the danger for the person who has not become enlightened to the extent of becoming aware of their eros and thanatos in their unconscious, you know, what Freud called eros and thanatos, and who is not aware of that and therefore driven by blind drives and impulses, those impulses will drive them toward some places where they won't end up being happy when they kind of wake up in a body, or in a womb, or in an egg, or in whatever it might be. And therefore, you know, I mean, just to give you an example, one Lama, a friend of mine, who, late Lama, he passed away a long time back, but he was with me, and he lived with us for a while in Amherst when I taught there years ago, 30 years ago, and he was very upset about Miss Piggy. He really was upset about Miss Piggy. And he watched himself, Miss Piggy, thought she was quite cute, but then he got all worried, and we said, well, what's wrong, Rinpoche? He said, well, some child might fall in love with Miss Piggy. And then if they died prematurely in an accident or some disease or something, they might gravitate toward a pig rebirth. And he was very worried about it. He said, they shouldn't be showing that all the time in such color with lipstick and whatever, you know, and all golden tresses, and Miss Piggy, you know. And he was really worried about it. And we kept saying, but Rinpoche, the Buddhists always had animal stories, and they had, like, the nice rabbit who jumped and fed the traveler and got drawn his picture in the moon and blah, blah, blah. Like Lassie-type stories, Disney stories. He said, yeah, but they didn't have it on TV and making imprint in the mind like many hours a day, you know, type of thing. So he was very concerned about it. But that's an idea of how they understand it in their own common sense plane.
Part of the Force for Good class series happening at Tibet House US in New York City. To access the original recording, please visit the Tibet House US membership archives at tibethouse.us. This podcast and the Force for Good class series was brought to you in part through the generous support of the Tibet House US membership community and listeners like you. To learn more, please visit tibethouse.us. And now back to Bob with the second half of this week's episode.
So it's hard to imagine that there we can evolve to be a being who feels we are everyone, every single being in the universe. They say that they define Buddhahood as a being that considers every being like a mother considers her only beloved child, which they get all dewy-eyed when they say that. I think, poor guy, poor Buddha. Because look at what they're doing, all those naughty children. Crazy. So, but that's because they are, you know, that's, but yet he's still, you don't become just all of them, and then you couldn't contribute anything to them. So both you're all of them, and yet you are someone who can help them by being different from them, by seeing their own highest potential realized in them, but seeing that they are not realizing it, and then seeing what does it take to motivate them to want to realize it, and what capabilities do they need to get to realize it, and how can you lead them, teach them? That's why they say the greatest thing Buddhas do is teach. Of all the Dzongpa, in his short essence of eloquence, he has a verse, of all the deeds of enlightened beings, their speech is the most important. Therefore, the wise praise only praise enlightened beings for their speech. Because and what do? When we speak? When we have a conversation, when you speak to me, your mind is shared. You should share your mind with me when you speak to me. When I speak to you, I share my mind with you. So in a way, we have when we listen to each other, we open our mind to the other. Give them the privilege of entering our mind by saying something. Now, it's very imperfect. And words don't, just like words don't capture the pillar, they don't capture the apple, they don't capture the self, the nose, that what we say is not perfect, doesn't share our innate experiences, our deeper experiences, even transverbal experiences. But they do some sharing. They help us in some way. So speech is really, like karma, evolution, the three levels of evolution, physical, mental, and verbal. And the verbal evolution is really important, the four good and bad paths of verbal evolution, like lying versus telling the truth is huge, the difference between that. Telling the truth means sharing what you can see about reality with the other person. Lying is trapping them in a false reality, and yourself goes in there with them, right? And so it's isolating, and it's bad for you. So dualism... it's not like dualism. There was one Chinese guy, Jizang, who very cleverly did. He has duality and non-duality. Then neither duality or non-duality and both duality. You know, they go on like that. Because duality keeps doing that. You know? It keeps on doing that. It doesn't stop. Like they say, we never say there's the Asanga or Maitreya says in one verse in the universal vehicle discourse, ornament, or literature. He says, we never say there's one Buddha and we never say there are many Buddhas. It's not Pali Buddha or Mono Buddha. Because in the Dharmakaya, the reality body level, there's no difference between all Buddhas. They're all one. And also, all enlightened beings are one with all unenlightened beings. Because when you have that, when you become enlightened and have that reality body experience, you feel you are all other beings, their bodies and minds. You feel everything, the pillar and the buildings and the planets, and it's all you. You feel that. Just like now I feel this is me, which must be something amazing. You know. On the other hand, each individual being that was a separate being, self-centered separate being, has the bliss of becoming this oneness in their own way. So the form body of a Buddha are unique. Each one is unique. And their context within which they find this complete oneness with others is unique, and they enjoy the oneness. Their own, their each one's bliss is unique. And so, but and then in that case, your freedom from suffering is not your personal thing only. Since you're already in nirvana and you're already interconnected with many beings, and if you knew your own infinite past, you would know you were interconnected with every being. You cannot enjoy this as nirvana unless everyone enjoys it as nirvana. So then you have to take up the bodhisattva idea that you have to help all beings become free of suffering. You have to fix the world, so to speak, right? And it's easier to make such a heroic, messianic resolution if you think the world is this more diaphanous, mutable stuff, mind stuff. Because you know you know how radical mind can change. You kind of have a feeling of the world, like vast oceans and mountains and continents and planets and galaxies and whatever. How can anybody change that? That's the vast material thing, seems the external object, what they call it, seems hopeless, type thing. So it's the way I think personally is the entrance. They call it a Sangha, who was the Maitreya, the future Buddha, and a Sangha, the great champion of the mind-only philosophy. I think they were really opening the door for a lot of people to develop this heroic bodhisattva attitude. And that philosophical metaphysic that is in a way mentalistic reductionism gave people the courage to change the universe, to take up the goal of changing the universe, which of course is not as crazy as it seems to materialists. You know, if you have a messianic, I think probably in the diagnosis book of the psychiatrists, a messianic complex is a disease, right? And someone says, I'm going to save the world. They say, okay, well, over there in Bellevue, in the next ward, you're going to have Jesus and Napoleon and Muhammad. They'll all be there. So you go and join them, and then we'll give you some Prozac and some lithium and Librium, and we'll be cool. And so it's some dementia, because who can change the world when you don't need to bother? You just die, and you'll be nothing anyway. And the world is essentially nothing, and it's this accident, random mutation, and we're all running around thinking we're existing, and it's just silly, because reality, which has been discovered by MIT, that we don't exist. And it's all nothing, ultimately. It's real reality is nothing. There's the absolute is nothingness for the materialists. And they rejoin that absolute by dying. Completely incoherent and irrational and psychotic idea, but they do. This idea that nirvana is elsewhere and yet it's the absolute is catering to that psychosis, actually. But it's kind of making it like, well, I'll get there and I'll be selfless and I'll be free. And in the process of doing that, then you get free from your inner drives and compulsions, and then you become more capable of contemplating the idea of being in freedom with everybody else and therefore being responsible for them all. And then the idea of compassion comes out of it, if you follow me. That's a Mahayana kind of view. Okay, anyway, so the first two chapters, he's expounding this Vijnanavada view, and he's going to a sutra which is called the Elucidation of the Intention Sutra, which is a very important one for Asanga, and he quotes it, Paramartha Samudgata. This name even of the person in the sutra is Paramartha, means ultimate reality, and Samudgata means who has arisen into ultimate reality or from ultimate reality. Could be either way. It's a compound in Sanskrit. You can analyze the compound in either way. But that's the name of the main interlocutor in this sutra, Paramartha Samudgata. Anyway, he states in the Elucidation of Intention Sutra, he's speaking to Buddha. He says, the Lord proclaims in many discourses the intrinsic identity of the aggregates, their characteristics of production and destruction, their abandonment, and etc. It goes on, all the things. He talks about things as if they were intrinsically, identifiably present. Now, intrinsic identity is a very, I took out a footnote I had here, but it means svalakshana, literally one's intrinsic mark, almost, or marking, intrinsic identity. And it's a concept. You know, I don't know if you've studied, if anybody here is a big student of philosophy, but you know, from the time of Wittgenstein, there's something that happened in Western philosophy, they call it the linguistic turn. someone in French guy called Saussure, who was a linguist. And the idea that language is creating the categories of philosophical thought, and it's part of the sort of idea that metaphysics is useless, that they wrongly and nihilistically misinterpreted it. But the linguistic turn is very good because it's, in philosophy, metaphysics, because it's realizing the power of language in constructing our realities. And so, you know, since Wittgenstein and that Saussure guy and some of the French people who were, you know, Derrida was a big one who did subsequently to Wittgenstein. But the Buddhists did that thousands of years ago. You know, and that words, that our reality is structured by words. And intrinsic identity is essential to that because intrinsic identity means that my word for table, that there's something in the table, that my word table that seems to identify it as a table lands on. It's something like another synonym for it could be intrinsic referentiality. That as a referent, you know, you say the term book, the referent of the term book is book. But there's something in the book that is intrinsic to the book that makes book land on it. And Wittgenstein is great on that. And that's why I use Wittgenstein in my study of this top of this book, because Wittgenstein says metaphysicians over the centuries, they look at a book and they go, book. And he has this great thing in philosophical investigation. He says, and it's as if they were conferring an inner baptism on the object by looking at it and going, book. And you know, Socrates, you know, Plato thought that what makes a book is the pure form in some sort of like conceptual heaven of bookness. And that this book instantiates in a particular the universal, immortal universal of bookness. And in a really naive level, it gets connected to different cultures of the actual words in the different language. And therefore, when people had like horrible crusades and things like God, you know, Jehovah is not Allah, you know. You can't call him Allah, then I'm going to kill you because his name is Jehovah or it's God. Or, you know what I mean? It's like, it's the language. This is not a mesa. This is a table, you know. They say chokze in some other language. What are they talking about? There's no intrinsic chokzehood in here. Chokze is Tibetan for table, like a Chinese word. So intrinsic identity is a very important level. There's intrinsic reality. There's intrinsic objectivity. And there's intrinsic identity. Those are three levels of philosophical sophistication getting greater and greater. Intrinsic reality is the more superficial one, where you think something is real because it's sort of what they call an ontology. You know, you think that it's really a pillar. It has, and its reality as a pillar is intrinsic to it. Its reality as a pillar is not that it's standing on a floor, that it's made of concrete, has reinforcing rod, that it's holding up the roof. You know, that it's a completely contextual thing, and also it's arbitrary. The pillar and the base of the pillar and the floor under it and the roots of the pillar, you know, we stop only and say pillars from floor up and from ceiling down. You know, it's like, you know, it's all very arbitrary, but intrinsic reality means that it has something inside itself that's pillarness about it. It's that phrase I think I used last time, massive facticity as a pillar. And even the idealists say that as a mental object, although it's a notion in the mind that creates the perception of pillar, but that's a real notion in the mind. It's intrinsically identifiably a pillar. It's intrinsically objectively a pillar. It's intrinsically really a pillar. Then intrinsic objectivity is on the epistemological level, a level of knowledge. My sense of it being a pillar as an object, there's an object, a massive objectivity in it. And then the identity is that my ability to say pillar to it lands on an intrinsic referent of my term, my concept and term pillar. That's its intrinsic identity. And that's more subtle, because that's already a conceding power of language to give us the concepts of which we perceive things. And it's not just a Buddhist idea. You know, Shelley or Keats or somebody, I always mix up which one of them, said, poets are the unacknowledged legislators of mankind. One of them said that. And what they meant by that was that a poet sees something beyond the given categories of a culture at a certain moment and poetically expresses that, and then people kind of get that, and they see that flower that way, or that dewdrop that way, or that ocean that way, or whatever it is. And then that term that was kind of a breakthrough of a deeper subtlety of seeing it that the poet did, then that becomes part of your conceptual dictionary. And then you can see things that way. So they're legislating how you perceive things, in other words, is what they meant by that. And so there they're aware that language is creating things, and that's what I'm saying.
Dependent designation.
What?
Dependent designation. Dependent designation.
Yeah, dependent, that's right. Yeah, dependent origination as dependent designation. Correct, correct. So anyway, what he's saying is you talk about all these things as if they were intrinsically identifiable. He says, oh, Buddha, you do. But now, then you also say that intrinsically they're unreal, they're not produced, they're not ceased, they're primordially peaceful, they're naturally and totally liberated. So I wonder about this and earnestly inquire of Lord Buddha, what do you mean when you say, and he speaks his because he's being sort of honorific, you proclaim intrinsic unreality, non-production, non-cessation, primordial peace, and natural total liberation of all things. Because these are two contradictory statements about things. So what do you mean? And here, now Nagarjuna, who we later come, you know, the Madhyamakas, the centrists, they say, well, Buddha is not saying that they have intrinsic identity as, you know, suffering and release and production and destruction and abandonment, and et cetera, and aggregates and foods and elements and originations and remedies, resistances, et cetera. He's not saying they're intrinsically identifiable. He's saying they're relatively there. And when he says they're unreal, he's talking about their intrinsic nature, their ultimate nature, in other words. So they just have a duality. They have the two realities to deal with to reconcile this contradiction in the Buddha's thing. But Asanga doesn't like that, and Maitreya. And he says, he has Buddha say in this sutra, and Buddha himself doesn't like that. He says, I teach the intrinsic unreality of all things, intending the following three types of such unreality: identity unreality, production unreality, and ultimate unreality. So in other words, my unrealities have three different things. And basically what he does is he says, things are intrinsically identifiable relatively, and they're ultimately intrinsically identifiable, but conceptually, they are not. So when I say they're unreal, that is, they're unreal in regard to corresponding to your concepts. But in some sort of ineffable relativity, they are real, identifiable. And, of course, the ultimate and the relative are the same thing, really. So he adds a third dimension to it, the dimension of conceptuality. Rather than just relative and ultimate, he has relative, ultimate, and then conceptual relative. And conceptual relative is the one that his negations are pertaining to, he says. Okay?
Weekly interstitial music provided by Tenzing Chogyal. Used with the artist's permission, all rights reserved. To learn more about the music of Tenzing Chogyal, please visit his website at tenzingchogyal.com. This episode was originally recorded at the Tibet House U.S. Force for Good class series, now happening in New York City and online with Robert Thurman and friends. To learn more about this ongoing series, please visit tibethouse.us. Thanks for tuning in this week, and we hope to see you on March 3rd at Carnegie Hall as Philip Glass is joined by Carly Simon, Patty Smith, and friends for the annual Tibet House U.S. Benefit Concert and Party. For ticket information and full concert lineup, please visit tibethouse.us. Tasha Dalek, and thanks for tuning in.